Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silken in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Nice to see you.
All right. So in the past couple of weeks, there's been a number of major sporting events. So this is our sports episode that we have once every 6 months or so. So we've had two big...
You're live on the Fan. Who's our next caller, David?
Oh, Jesus, Frank. Okay. New York slash Boston sports radio is now the angle we're going for. Anyway, some interesting recent sporting news. A couple weeks ago, there were some regular season games between the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox that were held not in either Boston or New York, but in London. They played a couple of games. Frank, do you remember who won those games?
Yes, I do. Okay, do you remember who won the World Series last year, David?
Do you remember who? Never mind. We're not going to.
Yes, listeners, David is a Yankee fan. That won't surprise you. And I'm a Red Sox fan.
I'm not sure why they would or wouldn't be surprised by that. But anyway.
You're such a Yankee fan.
I'm not sure I know what that means. But
oh, you know.
I'm not sure our listeners know what that means. Which was the first time that a regular season baseball game has been played in the UK. Just a couple days ago, the U.S. team won the World Cup, and so we'd like to talk about what these two events say about the United States and sports on the global stage.
They won the World Cup in women's football, David.
Yes,
there's a cricket World Cup going on right now too.
Or for our American listeners, women's soccer. We're gonna have to choose like what we're gonna call this sport.
It's football, David.
We're an American history podcast.
We
right?
live in the UK. Kay. It's football.
Okay, fine.
It's football. Well,
listeners, we're gonna call it football. But if you are thinking it will translate to soccer in your head, it's fine.
But anyway, you've totally ignored the Cricket World Cup.
It's not only have I ignored it in my introduction, I've ignored it in my real life as well. I have only so much room in my brain for things.
It's being held in the UK right now. It's being held in England right now.
Okay. And how's it going?
It's going very well. In fact, up to the minute, live scores here on the Fan. New Zealand just upset India in one of the semifinals, and England are playing Australia in the other one.
Oh.
Tomorrow.
Well, congratulations to New Zealand for that upsetting win.
New Zealand are good. They're very good.
Oh, good. Good for them. Let's start with the baseball, since that happened first chronologically. What sense do you make of why Major League Baseball decided to host a game between the Yankees and the Red Sox in London? What does that say about what they're trying to do, about the way baseball works? Baseball, people think of it as being I saw articles in British newspapers and magazines trying to explain American baseball to a British audience. What are they trying to do, put having a game in London?
I think what they were trying to do is what some of the other three major sports leagues in North America, the National Hockey League, the National Football League, that is American football, and the National Basketball Association, have all played games in Europe in recent years or internationally. And I think it's about trying to, they say, grow the sport and expand the brand and all sorts of nonsense like this. And I think that was the intention of Major League Baseball in holding these games. They took, with respect to fans of other teams like the Dodgers and the Cardinals and so on, they took two of the marquee franchises and probably the biggest rivals in the game and brought them to London. And I think the hope was to generate a lot of excitement and interest. I think it was I happened to be in London right before those games for another reason, and it was very interesting because there were a lot of Yankee and Red Sox fans in town. I mean, I'm basing this on the kind of paraphernalia I saw and the voices I heard and talking to people in my hotel who'd come from New York for the weekend or from New Jersey. They were Yankee fans who'd come for the weekend to see the games. They played a pair of games at West Ham Stadium. But I'm not sure it made much of an impression generally. I don't know how to measure this necessarily. And the reason for that is, well, actually, sort of joking aside, the Cricket World Cup is on, which so for people who follow ball and bat sports in the UK,
you only have one.
So you don't have to have one, but the one that is the biggest. In fact, I think Australia was playing on the Saturday in London in the Cricket World Cup, the same day the Yankees were playing the Red Sox in London, and I think that was probably more attractive. And so I think it was up against the Cricket World Cup. It was also against up against the soccer or football Women's World Cup as well at the same time. And England was doing quite well in that at that point, was still in the tournament. And so I just don't think it necessarily got the bandwidth that it might have. However, in answer to your question, why did they do it? I think Major League Baseball has probably looked at the relative success of the NFL, American football, in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they've had a game a year. A couple games a year.
Yeah. And there's talk about putting a franchise in London that I think isn't entirely fanciful. Now, what's in it for the British or English, if it's in London, is there are stadia around London for the various soccer teams. And, you know, if you're running a business, if you own a stadium, you don't want an empty, you want the venue used.
Sure.
And so if you can schedule around, if you could sort of co-host, and there's talk about, I think, Spurs, Tottenham Hotspur sharing its new stadium with an NFL franchise. If you can sort of make sure you schedule the games on alternate weekends around the Premier League, it's not a crazy thing to do. And there is a kind of, I mean, I've lived in the UK now since 1992, and there's a kind of core British audience for American football. I mean, it's a little bit of an affectation. No, affectation is the wrong word. It's a minority sport. There's no doubt about it. But there's a kind of indigenous British fan base for American football. Whether these are people who've lived in the United States or just picked it up because it's been on television here for 30 years, that doesn't exist for baseball, as far as I can tell. I mean, I know British baseball fans because they've been in the States or whatever. But as a rule, I don't think there's the same fan base for baseball in the UK that there is for American football. I think MLB, Major League Baseball, might be envious of that and seeking to start it. I'm not so sure it's a good idea. I'm not so sure it's going to work. I mean, they've held games in Mexico City before. They started the season this year, and this is the second year running, I think, in Japan. They've played Major League Baseball has played games outside of the United States before, regular season games, and will continue to do so. But they've done so in places where baseball has historically been played. They're trying to break into a new market. And even if they wanted a new market in Europe, baseball is a little bit more popular in Germany and Italy, for example. If you look at the World Baseball Classic, which is baseball's answer to the World Cup, those teams are more competitive than the British team, in part because, well, for historic reasons, and we don't necessarily need to go into them, but I think London was an odd choice. I think London, but I think MLB looked at what the NFL is doing and what the NBA is doing. The NBA is probably the most successful of these leagues internationally in terms of marketing itself. And with a little bit of envy, and was trying to break into a new market, but I'm not so sure it worked.
I mean, one of the interesting things I think about baseball is where it is spread to and where it is not spread. Because, I mean, I think there have been various efforts to expand baseball beyond the bounds of North America throughout its history. And some of those have really taken and some of those really haven't. We can think about the way in which baseball spread into Latin America and has been wildly popular there, the way it's spread to Japan and been extraordinarily popular there. But efforts to spread to other places largely haven't generated the same kind of cultural interest. I mean, we were talking before, we both revealed that we have a interest in someday in writing a book on the Spalding World Tour from 1888-1889, which was in some ways an effort to try to spread baseball outside the United States.
There's great photos of them at the Sphinx and things like this. It was
So I mean, the background to this world tour is this is sort of baseball players didn't make a lot of money during playing baseball. Pro baseball was really in its infancy, and so they often did these sort of barnstorming tours during the off season, and which they did well into the 20th century. But this one was led by Al Spalding, which was one of the early great professional baseball players, a pitcher. he organizes
and an entrepreneur.
He mostly becomes an entrepreneur after this tour in some ways. He organizes the Chicago White Stockings, which are now the Cubs, which is confusing for obvious reasons. Versus they had sort of to play versus like an all-star team of other people. And they traveled from the United States to Hawaii, which was then the Sandwich Islands, because it was not yet part of the United States. They went from there to New Zealand and Australia. And at that point, that was supposed to be the entire tour, but they decided then to extend it. They went and played in Egypt, in Italy, in France, and in the UK.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting in terms of how it spread, David. I mean, that tour is great, and it is a coincidence. We were, as you said, before we went on the air, we both mentioned this tour and both said, well, I'm thinking of writing a book about that someday, so maybe we'll collaborate on a book someday. Or we'll write competing books on Spalding's World Tour.
Or what we need to organize is a travel trip to go to all the places where they play it, to go to Hawaii.
With reference to your question about why is it spread, mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a pretty close correlation between its spread and the spread of American power and influence. So you mentioned Latin America. It's not popular. Baseball's not popular across Latin America. It's popular in the parts of Latin America where the United States has had a substantial military presence. Mm. So you're really talking about the Caribbean basin, you're talking about Mexico, Venezuela.
But it
hasn't penetrated deep into South America apart from that Caribbean coast, really.
To be sure.
But I think there is a kind of correlation with gunboat diplomacy, but it didn't spread very far, for example, to the Philippines, which is a little bit surprising, right, given the history of the United States and the Philippines. Basketball did, interestingly. And its history with imperialism, it's not so simple as to say, oh, it correlates with American imperialism, because, you know, one of the real hotbeds for baseball, one of the countries where baseball is most important, arguably more important than it is in the United States, is Cuba. And baseball spreads to Cuba in the late 19th century. It's embraced by Cubans who are resisting Spanish rule, mm-hmm. because America, the United States, and its culture is associated with modernity and resistance to Spain.
Neutral.
And so Cuban revolutionaries start playing baseball, and there's a Cuban revolutionary baseball tradition that antecedes or is kind of at odds with the kind of traditional view of American gunboat diplomacy spreading baseball.
So I think some of the early people to bring baseball to Cuba were native Cubans who came to the United States for college or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And then brought to, and in some ways, some of the places that it spread in Latin America didn't come from the United States, but came from people, those other, you know, Venezuela. I think Venezuelan baseball comes from its relationship with Cuba as much as from its relationship with the United States. The interest in baseball in Japan, I think, is really interesting, because that really also, you know, has interesting connections with American sort of imperial motives. But you know, there are professional tours, sort of like the Spalding Tour, of American players in Japan. You know, in the early decades of the 20th century, there's one.
Yeah, it antedates the American military occupation.
I mean, there's one in 19... I just checked this morning. There's one in 1908, one 1913, one 1920, one 1922, one 1931. And probably the big ones in 1934. This is the one that brought Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Lefty Gomez and Jimmy Fox and all those guys.
And Mo Burke.
And I was thinking, and the most important player, who was the worst player on the team probably, the catcher Mo Berg, who also happened to be a spy, and apparently was doing some covert actions while touring Japan as part of this tour. But professional baseball in Japan basically started immediately after Babe Ruth et al. Left, and most historians of Japanese baseball sort of connect it to how well received that tour was, and how many people came to see the games, and how receptive they were to it. But we can think of lots of places where baseball then hasn't picked up, and I'm not entirely sure why that is.
Well, why would it? I mean,
because it's an amazing game, and
sure, but I mean, there are lots of amazing games. I mean, you and I again off air, we're talking about cricket. You clearly have no interest in cricket, which is yet again one of your. I'll add that to the list of your moral failings.
But, I have many moral failings,
but Now, cricket's an amazing game. America, well, actually, it's growing in the United States, but we'll leave that aside. We can talk about that another time if you like. But, you know, why would it necessarily spread? I mean, you know, there are indigenous and local sporting cultures that exist in other countries, well, and other cultures. So, because I mean, it has spread beyond those places. So, for example, it's in Korea as well. There's a professional league in Korea. There's a bizarre kind of baseball subculture. Well, I say bizarre. That's in Australia. Mm. And there are a number of Australians who now play in Major League Baseball as a consequence of this. And given the potency and power of cricket and the dominance of cricket in Australia, that's a little surprising. So it has spread in other parts of the world a little bit. But, I mean, I guess my response to your question would be a question, why would it spread?
Well, because we live in an extraordinarily sort of globalized world, and sports is a kind of entertainment, and, you know,
it's a complicated, slow game that's hard to learn.
No, that's fine.
The skills necessary aren't natural necessarily. You know, I mean, kicking a ball is pretty simple. Everybody kicks a ball. It's not a game for this century.
True, that's true.
It's the popular cultural equivalent of slow food, as is cricket.
Okay.
I'm slightly bemused by your question. I don't think
it's interesting. Well, that, you know, I think, as we mentioned, like sports like basketball really have taken over as a sort of dominant cultural product around the world. You know,
it's fast and simple. It doesn't require lots of space. It's high scoring. It's everything baseball isn't.
All these things are true. All right, let's.
I mean, what's your opinion before we move on? I mean, what's your opinion of these games that were played in New York, in London? Oh, by the way, I don't think I acknowledged that the Yankees won the game.
No,
the
we didn't have to. Everyone listening knows that. One of the things I've noticed about the way baseball its trajectory over the past 25 years is the sport seems to be trying to figure out how to sort of reinvent itself, thinking about what does baseball look like in the 21st century. I think there have been a kind of stagnation in you know, sports need, like anything else, needs to evolve and change. And baseball as a sport, I think, is very resistant to change by its very nature. It is a very traditional sport in a way that lots of other sports are more amenable to change. You know, you think about the NFL changes its rules fairly regularly, and modern American football is, you know, very different from what existed 50 years ago. Modern baseball looks very, very similar to
roughly the same. I mean, it's a little bit different.
But you know, they changed the mound 2 inches, and that's considered a revolutionary kind of, you know, change. You know, and I think sort of looking across the pond, I think it's an interesting experiment, but I think you're right, it's probably not going to catch on in the UK.
The sporting calendar's full here.
Well, that's true.
First of all, football, soccer dominates the culture in a way that, you know, it's almost 12 months a year, but it's certainly 10 months a year. And then, you know, you've got rugby, you've got cricket. I mean, there's a vibrant sporting culture in this country. And there's little space for something new, I think.
Okay. Well, I think that's an interesting, you know, mentioning the sort of prominence of football in the UK, I think is an interesting sort of transition point to thinking about the World Cup that just culminated a couple of days ago. How are we to make sense of the U.S. women's team's dominance over the past couple decades in the World Cup? I think this is what, their fourth World Cup?
Fourth World Cup. And they've also won 4 Olympic gold medals. And it, unlike in men's soccer, the Olympic competition really matters.
Mm-hmm.
Because so there are 2 major international competitions in women's soccer, and they're the World Cup and the Olympics. And the United States has won 4 of each of them, basically since the early 90s, which is pretty... Well, let me put it to you this way. In men's soccer, Italy, which is considered one of the global powers of the game, has won 4 World Cups over the past century.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. women have won 4 World Cups in a generation.
So they are by far, for those listeners who haven't been following, they are really an extraordinarily dominant team, even if they're not always the same players. Every, you know, obviously, you have lifespan of a football player isn't
well, the first couple of World Cups were in the 90s,
and so yeah, they've had a a generational shift on the team, but they've still been phenomenally dominant. How do we make sense of that? What does that say about sports in the United States, women's sports in the United States, and the popularity or of football/soccer in the U.S.
I think
you grew up playing.
I did grow up playing soccer, and I really love soccer. It's probably my one. It's my first love of sport. It might be, and I watch it here as well. So I have had season tickets for a local team for a while and things like that. So I think Title IX explains it. You know, the legal requirement that universities and educational institutions had to spend equal money on women's sports that they spend on men's sports. Beginning in the 1970s, meant that if major universities, I'm thinking of your alma mater, one of your alma maters, North Carolina, for example, which was very good in both men's and women's soccer. If they wanted to spend money on their basketball program or their American football program, they had to put money into women's team sports as well. And the women's sport that benefited most from that, not exclusively, because lacrosse has done quite well, and women's ice hockey and women's basketball as well, but has been soccer.
Yeah.
And so I think that part, I think that partially explains it. I think we've also had the generation, since I'm older than you, but since we were kids, we heard the United States is coming on in soccer because all these kids are playing youth soccer. Well, that's true, but what happens is when you start playing youth soccer, it's often both boys and girls together. The culture values and rewards boys' sports more than girls' sports. And we can talk about the pay dispute in a second if you want. But the cultural rewards for boys are in those other major sports, by and large. I think that's changing a little bit. But you know, if you're a good athlete and you're a boy, you know, the cultural rewards and the monetary rewards in the United States are much higher for American football, basketball, ice hockey, or baseball than they are for soccer. So the good male players, I think, get hived off.
Or at least some of them do.
Or some of them do. So whereas the really good girls and then women stay playing soccer. So I think there's been a culture that, I think that predicted boom in American soccer happened, but it happened in women's soccer, not in men's soccer.
Yeah.
I think we've seen that. But also, I think it's, Britain is really, really dominant in track cycling. You may or may not know.
Yes.
Right? One of the reasons is it's a relatively new Olympic sport, and when it became a new Olympic sport, Britain invested heavily in it. And it turns out money and success are closely correlated in sports. So similarly, women's soccer, well, the history of women's international soccer goes back as far as men's. It's been intermittent. It hasn't been as consistent. So the Women's World Cup in its current form is basically, began, I think, in 1991. So it's a relatively new, it's a relatively recent vintage. And the United States actually got in on the ground floor of that, having Title IX was already in place for a generation at that point. It had a leg up. If you look at the dominant teams in women's soccer historically, and by historical, I mean if you go back to the first World Cups, you know, for the past almost 30 years, they have tended to be, it's been the United States, it's been the Nordic countries, been Germany to some extent, and China. So it's been countries that have invested in women's sports. And the reason I made the analogy to Britain and track cycling is the United States got in there on the ground level. When it won its first couple of World Cups, frankly, the quality of play wasn't that good and the competition wasn't that good. What's been striking about the past two World Cups, especially the one recently completed, is the American women are really, really good, but the level of competition is much higher than it was when Mia Hamm was playing, for example.
Sure.
So, I mean, the Americans are better at the moment, but, you know, that England semifinal was a really good game, and it was a really close game. And so I think the gap is closing, and that advantage that is equivalent to what Britain has in track cycling is going to diminish or is diminishing. So I'm not sure, and I think this is, it's only, women's soccer will only, one reason it's taken off in the way it has is because it's more competitive. And so it will be good when you get major rivalries. And the United States make excellent rivals because everybody wants to beat them, in part because of their on-field demeanor, which I have some issues with.
Well, let's get to that in a second. Well, I think we should unpack Title IX first, because I think some of our listeners may be familiar with it, but some of them might not be. This is a educational amendment in 1972. It's part of a set of educational amendments to a 65 education bill, which was an amendment to a 62 education bill, if I recall. And the premise of it was not necessarily, like, there's nothing in Title IX that actually mentions sports. It's actually a very short piece of legislation. It's about equal funding for gender in educational programs, that you cannot discriminate based on gender. And there had been an earlier title, I don't remember which one, that has to do with race and ethnicity, and so this was adding gender to the mix of categories about things you cannot discriminate against. So it wasn't intended. When people say Title IX, they often think of sports, and I think there's actually a women's, like, sporting brand clothing company that's called Title IX, and so that's what people think of. But that's actually not the full breadth of what Title IX is about. Title IX is about gender equity in education. But, you know, in terms of sports, I think you're right. It has had this huge impact on the number of women who participate at the high school and at the university level, and in the kinds of resources they get. Because, you know, universities had women's teams prior to Title IX, but not very many of them. They didn't have the same sort of facilities that the men did. They didn't have the same quality of coaching that the men did. In many cases, probably still don't, but at least now there's this legal framework that has really revolutionized women's sports in the United States. And I think the victories of the World Cup are, I think you're right, that's probably the easiest sort of mechanism for explaining it.
But don't forget the generation of youth soccer as well.
Oh, George, be sure, sure, yeah, time. Yeah, yeah.
Or two generations.
And I think those things actually sort of melded together closely. You know, one of the things that I think that's interesting about Title IX is that it's women's sports at the university level are now on par with, or near par, or at least in the same ballpark, pardon the pun, with men's teams. What does this say, though, when you sort of translate then into the professional ranks? Because the women's team, are one of the things that people are noticing and complaining about right now, is the women's team is clearly extraordinarily good, but they are paid much less than the men's team. And women athletes are on the whole paid a lot less than their male counterparts. What does that say about the status of U.S. sports right now, and what do you think is going on there?
Well, again, I think you're being a little parochial, David. I don't think it's just U.S. sports, because I think
I'm a very parochial. I'm an American. Yeah, okay, sorry.
I think there's a, what we see is that there's a disjuncture between the interest in following international competition, so nations, teams representing countries, as opposed to club sports. Right?
Yeah.
And I think this is a global phenomenon. So, for example, the WNBA, the Women's National Basketball Association in the United States, does not attract the same audiences that the NBA does. Similarly, there's a Women's Premier League in soccer here in the UK and in England, and it does not attract, you know, so there are Arsenal Ladies Club or whatever. You know, there are women's teams for most of these clubs, and for most of the big soccer teams you can think about in the UK. And leagues comparable to the men's leagues, but they don't attract the same audiences, they don't attract the same television contracts. And so there just doesn't seem to be the same interest. There's an interest in watching international level team competition, but there's not the equivalent interest in watching club competition. And because of that, there's a disparity in the amount of revenue available for these sports. So it's in many cases, to take the Premier League example, the Premier League teams are subsidizing their women's team, taking the revenue from their very successful and very, from a financial standpoint, men's teams, and subsidizing the women's teams. And so that's a justification for paying women less at the club level. Now, at the international level, I don't think that's sustainable. I actually, and you know, there were chants of equal pay at the end of the World Cup final, the Women's World Cup final the other day on Sunday. I'm all in favor of equal pay in international football. I think that FIFA should mandate it. I don't think I slightly take issue with the fact that people have been citing the fact that the U.S. women are much more successful than the U.S. men. So on Sunday, the U.S. women won the World Cup, won their World Cup at the same time that the U.S. men lost yet again in the CONCACAF Gold Cup final, which is the regional international competition in men's football. They always lose to Mexico in the final. I've got theories why the U.S. men's team isn't as good as it might be. We can go into that if you like, but they lost. But so there was okay. a particular disparity on Sunday because the men failed yet again and the women won the world championship in their sport. But I think that's the wrong argument because I don't think it should be contingent upon results. I think the men's and women's teams should be paid the same regardless of results.
That seems like a very good argument.
So therefore, and I think that should apply to in every nation. I'm not saying all the nations should necessarily pay the same amount because they have different resources and they invest different amounts, but it seems to me that, you know, the men's and women's teams at the senior level in soccer or football should be paid the same no matter what country it is. But I think the argument that it's somehow contingent upon results and that the success of the Americans women's team, makes this disparity in pay more unjust is actually wrong-headed. I get it rhetorically, but I think
it is, you know, it sort of highlights the disparity that much more.
But it's become a bit of an article of faith with people saying, you know, using this as evidence. The evidence, the argument in favor of equal pay is natural justice, not results on the field.
Yes. But it's easier to make the claim about natural justice if you can say, look, they are, you know.
I agree.
If you're doing they are equal, then you can say, well, look, they are playing at the same level, and in some ways women are playing.
Well, and if you're going to make an economic argument, I don't know this for a fact, but I'd be interested to know the stats. I suspect that if they had a separate TV contract, the U.S. women would probably get a better contract than the U.S. men do. But I don't think that's true globally.
Yeah.
And I think this is not just a U.S. question, but a global question. And because this is a global sport. It is the global sport. And so I think it's wrong to see it in solely U.S. terms. Yeah. And I think a lot of the approach to the World Cup and a lot of the attitudes about pay, just the approach of many Americans to this World Cup is premised on American exceptionalism. And it annoys me.
Tell me, what are your thoughts? I mean, you're clearly following this much closer than I am because I'm an American and I only really follow American sports. And the degree to which the Women's World Cup and the American team is politicized in this particular moment, and the ways in which, say, there have been conflicts between the women's team and the current occupant of the White House about whether the team is going or not going and the way in which all this fits into gender politics. Is this the way that women's football usually plays out in other realms, or is this particular to this moment we're in right now?
It has played out that way in the past, although it's as with seemingly every other aspect of the culture at the moment, it's more intense at this particular moment. I think, look, this is a dominant team. And Americans like winners. And so one reason they attract the audiences that they do is because they're so good and they win. And frankly, they win with flair and style. They're really good to watch as a team. They're good to, you know, the way they play is if you're a soccer fan or a football fan, is very entertaining. So they attract an audience. They're outspoken. And unlike many other sports teams, not all, because, you know, the Golden State Warriors, for example, are outspoken and fairly critical of the Trump administration. Mm. A lot of the NBA is, in fact. But
and a decent portion of the NFL is.
Yes, but not the ownership in the NFL, which is pretty right wing. But anyway, but they've been critical. And Megan Rapinoe, especially the star of this World Cup and the star of this team, has been especially outspoken in her criticism of the president. And I think... we talked about Colin Kaepernick in an earlier episode. I think some people are unsettled. Well, they seem to say athletes should just shut up and play when those athletes are critical of when they represent left-wing politics. When it's right-wing politics, it's fine. And so I think this team is...
Well, then they don't say it as politics. Then they see it as being good patriots.
Exactly. And so I think the team engendered some controversy, but also a lot of support because of this. So if you will, they are the team of the resistance. in the United States, yeah. in part because they're all women and the resistance is to a large extent, but not only, female dominated. And so there's it fits this moment in all kinds of ways. And Megan Rapinoe in particular was a very admirable person as far as I can tell. A significant number of the players on the team are openly gay.
And I think the 50th anniversary of Stonewall at the same time, as you know, there's a synergy.
The zeitgeist is all there. There's no doubt about that. And so I think that, and of course, Trump always takes the bait. Yeah. He's so thin-skinned. So when Megan Rapinoe said she wouldn't go to the effing White House, he had to respond. You know, it's hard to imagine another president responding to that kind of provocation, but he always responds. And so that, of course, elevated them. And there was there was a scene which you may have seen after the game when Fox News was broadcasting from a bar in France and full of American fans, and they were chanting expletives about the president quite audibly on Fox News.
Yes, I saw that.
And so this team and its achievements have been politicized, in part because of the politics we talked about a moment ago, the politics of equal pay, but also the politics they've openly expressed. Which, to my mind, is fine. I have no problem with athletes expressing political views. And in this case, I happen to sympathize with their political views. My only criticism of this team is actually, it's not about their politics. It's not about their play. Well, it is about their play to a certain extent. I said on Twitter, I think they are the New England Patriots.
I'm not quite sure either team necessarily likes that. Anyway.
I'm sure both teams won't like that comparison. A period of sustained excellence that for fans of that team, they are blind to its flaws. A certain swagger that comes with that excellence that really annoys other people who are not fans of that team. And so I think the entire footballing world, and I followed it obviously on the BBC here, so most of what I saw was British coverage. Even when they were critical of the U.S. team, they were respectful and just said, "Look, this team is clearly the best." You know, it was very knowledgeable coverage. But there's a degree of resentment that comes with it because of their swagger. Now, the pushback on this has been, "Oh, you wouldn't criticize men for playing that way." Mm-hmm. But my criticism of them is their first group match when they beat Thailand 13-0, and they were gloating while scoring goals. When you're up 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 nothing, you don't have to gloat.
I guess it depends on whether you interpret it as gloating. Because I mean, one of the things they did do is they did cycle in some of the players who don't get as much time on the field as some of the other players.
Right, that's what you should do on those.
And when somebody scores their first World Cup goal, should you not celebrate? If we put you in the match and you scored your first World Cup goal, even if you were up by some ridiculous amount, would you celebrate?
There's a way to celebrate, David. I think they were way over the top in the game against Thailand.
Yeah.
I think they were way over the top again. And the pushback was a kind of feminist interpretation that they are beyond. I don't think you're beyond criticism because you're female. If you act like a jerk and you're female, you act like a jerk. And I think their behavior in the Thailand game was over the top and inappropriate. And it made me, I wanted them to win in the final, but I would have been very amused if they lost. I mean, I was rooting for Sweden because I have a personal interest in Sweden, and the Swedish women's team conducted themselves impeccably. They were in the same group with the United States. They beat Thailand without rubbing Thailand's nose in it. And Sweden's a very good team. But I thought the way they behaved in the Thailand game was appalling, actually. For a team that's as good as they are and has been that good for so long. And people said at the time, "Oh, well, you wouldn't say that if they were men, or would they have made this criticism of a men's team?" Well, in the last World Cup but one, when in Brazil, when Germany in the men's World Cup, when Germany beat Brazil 7-1, and when Germany was way up on Brazil, and that was a humiliation for Brazil in their own country, Jogi Löw, the German manager, did tell the team to kind of take it easy. Now, there's an argument that you should never take it easy. It's international football. It's the top flight, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, maybe there's an argument it's disrespectful to take it easy even if you're up by a lot.
Yeah, but you could say, actually, Germany playing Brazil, if Germany's playing Brazil, that's one thing. Thailand is a relative newcomer. If this is truly if the movement for women's soccer is a global one, the U.S. women actually have a responsibility to women's soccer around the world as the leading team. And I think they acted like jerks. They acted like the Patriots would have acted. That season the Patriots went 18-0 and then lost in the Super Bowl. That was funny. You know, then they were blowing people out and there was swagger. You know, people don't like it. Americans love it. I know this. I think they were wrong in that game. I don't think this makes them bad people. Yeah. I think it was, you know, it's... In the end, I rooted for them, but...
I only watched a bit of that game. I was not a devoted watcher of the World Cup, but it looked to me like the Thailand team was exhausted in the second half, and that was in large part why the American team was so able to be so dominant.
Well, it was 40 degrees Celsius.
But okay, but I mean, what it reminded me of... I went to basketball schools for undergrad and grad school, and the only games I ever went to were during Christmas break when they played really, really, I don't want to say bad teams, but schools that were much less basketball oriented than they were, where they'd win by 70 or 80 points with all of their second and third string players. And part of the reason why they won by so much is that the other team just exhausted itself in the first half, that playing defense against a really good team is exhausting. And so, you know.
Sure. I understand why they won, and I understand. Yeah. I'm not even... annoys me a little bit. It's the gloating, even if you score your first international goal, maybe show a little respect for your opponents. Okay. I think they disrespected their opponents.
Okay.
And I...
So women's team, if you're listening, which you're not...
They're not.
Frank is upset.
And the defense is, no, you wouldn't make that criticism of a men's team. And actually, I would make that criticism of a men's team. And if you... Yeah, I don't care. But I think there's a problem with it. And the gap is closing. They're going to lose.
Mm.
They're going to lose. And when they do, whoever beats them, the rest of the world is going to be cheering for. In part because one of the reasons I didn't like the gloating and the running up the score on Thailand, and you should be aware of this as an expat, David, is, you know what? Every time Americans abroad act like jerks, it makes life harder for us.
Yes.
And in this, they were downright Trumpian, despite their politics. I know they're opposed to Trump, but that was a Trump-like move, the way they behaved against Thailand. And that perpetuates a stereotype about Americans as obnoxious and overbearing bullies. And that's how they behaved.
Well, if accounts of Trump's golf game or anything, that also means they would have been cheating. But
they don't need to cheat.
Exactly. All right. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
I want to mention the Scheer Conference, which is the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic, which is in Boston, or Cambridge, Massachusetts next week. We're both going to be there.
Yes, we are both going to, yes.
I was the co-chair of the program committee this year with Sarah Pearsall from Cambridge. She's a good friend. Annette Gordon-Reed is the president. There are going to be a lot of, it's going to be a great conference. We're both going to be there. So if you're in Cambridge at the conference and you want to see us, send us a message because we'll be there. And we're probably going to record it. We're talking about recording an episode of the conference. We don't know what form it will take yet. So if you want to be on the podcast,
come. Us. Yes. And even if you're in the greater Boston area and you're not going to the conference, you know, we'll be around.
That's true. That's true.
Great.
What about you, David? What's your last
job? So I'm prior to going to Boston, I'm going to Philadelphia, where I'm doing an interesting event with a textile artist, a person by the name of Sonia Clark, who has made an enormous recreation of the Confederate surrender flag at the textile workshop, which is a museum in Philadelphia. We're doing an event together to talk about surrender. And her exhibition opened about the same time my book came out on surrender. And so we both sort of found each other saying, hey, we're both doing this. And we managed to pull this together to both be in the same place. And so, if you are in Philadelphia this coming Saturday, you can come hear both of us talk about surrender, both in an artistic venue and in historical context.
So you'll be literally waving the white flag.
She's got her flag, white flag, is pretty large. So it's bigger. It's actually sort of a recreation of the one that's in the Smithsonian, but 50 times enhanced.
So is that a political statement?
I think she. You'd have to ask her. Come find out on Saturday.
Okay.
I think it's she's thinking about what the end of the Civil War means for both through the ideology the Confederacy is embedded in and other things. But anyway, so it'll be my first interdisciplinary arts kind
of. You're on the cutting edge.
I know, something.
All right, see you in Cambridge.
Exactly. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.